Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. James Lanman. He's professor of philosophy at the University of Sheffield. He is known for his expertise on ethics. Dr. Lanman is a former president of the British Society for Ethical Theory. So, Dr. Lanman, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Hi, Ricardo.
Okay, great. So, I mean, my first question would be, today we're going to talk about ethics. Is it important for people to consider the motives behind actions in ethics? I mean, is that something important or not?
I think there's two ways of thinking about that question. I mean, it might matter ethically what our motives are in a particular way. So, for example, something I sometimes use to teach is the movie The Quiet American, based on the Graham Greene novel. And I don't know if you know the movie, but the central character in the film, towards the end, acts as an accessory to a man's murder. He participates in killing someone. And there's two reasons why what he does makes sense. One is that this man is up to no good. He's working for the CIA, doing various dirty tricks operation in 1950s Vietnam, and he's murdering people and doing terrible harm and behaving very badly in ways which arguably might mean that he can justifiably be murdered. There might be a reason why a principled person might think this is, as it were, an act of just war. Also, this man has seduced our hero's girlfriend, and his girlfriend has left him to run away with this man. And of course, it's a very good reason for someone to be upset, but no one thinks that's a good reason to murder someone. So the film invites us to ask the question, what's his motive? Is it this relatively honourable motive that this man's politically toxic? Or is it this quite dishonourable motive that he's just pissed at having his losing his girlfriend? That question is important in one way. I think most philosophers would say less important in another. There's the question, is what he does right? And very plausibly, it's right if there are good reasons for doing it that justify it. Whether or not those are his reasons, that's what makes a difference to whether it's right. So if the political considerations mean it's right what he does, then it's right what he does. But we also might ask questions about what this all says about this man's character. And that's a different question for whether what he does is right. And we might think, well, if his actual motive is sexual jealousy, then what he does is not right. Or sorry, what he does may be right, but it reflects poorly on his character. Whereas if his actual motive is desire to stop this guy in his murderous path, then that might reflect better on his character. And of course, what makes the film dramatically interesting is that not only do we, the audience, we're not sure what the correct explanation is, but we have a sense that he himself isn't sure. And he himself may be lying awake at night for the rest of his days, struggling with the question of whether he did something relatively honourable or whether he did something cheap and dishonourable. That's the particular question. You might also, there are more global questions you might ask. I mean, moral behaviour, morality is an important part of human life. And we think it's pervasively influences how we behave. There are, of course, pessimistic views of human nature where you might think actually morality is just, if I may use the word, bullshit, insofar as it's simply, it's largely fake. It's largely a word that Franz de Waal likes to use in some of his writings. It's veneer. It's something that we do in order to negotiate the world of status. By engaging in various forms of moralizing and by representing myself as a virtuous, righteous person, I can enhance my social standing. But really all that's going on is that this is just another mask worn by the will to power. And that's one way of being a pessimist, if you like, about the standing of morality. But it's not really the way that my own work has focused on, in that evaluating that kind of claim is going to be a difficult kind of claim to evaluate. It's going to be an empirical matter whether something like that is true. In my own work, I'm more interested in questions about whether morality is something we should be skeptical about for different reasons, because it perhaps embodies certain metaphysical presuppositions that we can't believe. And that's where my own focus is, because the questions raised by that are more philosophical and less empirical, and so easier for my particular brand of expertise to handle. But so, yeah, so motives enter in very particular kinds of ways, as they do in the central character of the film, but also we might be concerned about them in more global ways, if we're interested in whether we should be more or less optimistic about human nature, if you like.
Isn't it also a problem that many times when people are asked why they did something, in this case a moral behavior, they come up with post hoc rationalizations, and I mean they come up with a justification that sounds good to other people?
Yes, there's a lot of literature in moral psychology about the phenomenon of confabulation. It's usually called, and I thought in its strongest form, I think people want to suggest that human rationality is kind of mythical, and that we're pushed around by psychological forces that haven't got much to do with rationality, much more primal and instinctual kinds of things motivate us, and then we make up stories about what we are up to. There's got to be limits to that. At least some human beings, a lot of the time, do seem to behave in highly rational ways. When you get on an airplane, you're pretty confident that the guy flying the airplane is going to get you from Lisbon to London or wherever it is you're going safely, because he or she knows how to fly an airplane and will react to circumstances in intelligent ways. And there's lots of clear-cut cases of people behaving in ways that are smart, ways that are intelligent, clearly rationality is going on. But at the same time, confabulation, it's a thing. The questions are how much of what we do is rational, and how much of it is not so rational. Again, in my philosophical work at the moment, I'm actually trying to simply avoid questions like that. The book I'm trying to write at the minute is called The Possibility of Moral Community. And the claim I'm making is that there could be a race of beings that govern their lives by shared normative, rational, moral principles and shared understandings in ways that we might aspire to, and there could be such a race of people without it being the case that anything particularly metaphysically grandiose was true in the world where these people live. And without it being the case that these people are kidding themselves or deceiving themselves or believing anything that's false. And I put it that way precisely because I don't want to get stuck in these empirical questions about what we actual human beings are like. I just want to argue that it's possible that there could be creatures like that. Be nice if we were creatures like that, but that's a different inquiry. That's an inquiry for psychologists. My business as a philosopher is just to establish that that's at least a possibility. So that if there are obstacles, and there are many obstacles to human beings forming a functioning, flourishing moral community, at least those obstacles aren't metaphysical. They're obstacles that are more straightforward and practical kind, and that's the project I'm working on right now. So my focus isn't really on the confabulation people, but that's what they say.
Yeah. Are you interested in the consequences of people's actions? I mean, are you a consequentialist in any way?
I think the consequences of people's actions matter. Obvious. A consequence of my actions is that people die, then it's very sad that people die. It matters that people die. It would be better if people, better if people didn't die, at least prematurely. But in fact, of course, the consequences of my action are that people die. I have and will continue to kill many people. Don't call the police. So is everyone. When we think about the consequences of our actions, we think about the consequences of our actions in very, very local ways. And for the purposes of everyday life, that's good enough. But actually, the consequences of our actions go on happening forever, or at least for a very, very long time. If consequentialism is a view, and most consequentialists seem to think it is, that says, look, what determines the moral character of my action is the totality of its consequences, all of them, then I don't think that can possibly be true, because the totality of the consequence of my actions is just so vast and so epistemically inaccessible that can't be what's important. If that were true, then there would be no human action that we were able to say with any confidence that it was right or it was wrong, including the most horrible, the most obviously wicked acts of murder. We can't say clearly that they're wrong, but that's the true moral theory, and the most virtuous acts, we can't say that they were right. In a paper I wrote ages ago, I think about the genealogy of Adolf Hitler. So Hitler has two parents, and he has four grandparents, and he has 8 great-grandparents and 16 great-great, goes up in pairs of two. So by the time you're not very many generations away, you're talking about an awful lot of, we can imagine all the, here's Hitler's great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents down one particular line of this family tree. And here they are on their wedding night, making love. Happy, consensual, joyful sex between two young people who are married and love each other. There's nothing morally wrong is going on, it seems to me. But what those people are doing is causing the Holocaust. What those people are doing is bringing about the deaths of millions of people, because the existence of Hitler is causally dependent on what they're doing. And not just what they're doing, but of course what all their ancestors did. And what the person who invited them both to a party 2 years previously, without which, but for that, they wouldn't have met, he was causing the Holocaust, and so were his parents. The more you think about this, the more you realize that an awful lot of people caused the Holocaust, and a lot of those people caused the Holocaust by doing very, very, very small things that didn't seem very important. Some people, it was once just maybe they're all to blame, but the blame is shared between all of them, so none of them gets very much blame. And I would have said, no, that's wrong. None of them are to blame. They're all utterly innocent, those people. Hitler's to blame, and his associates, and his, the people who voted for him, perhaps. But the people, all the people who were causally down upstream of this happening, they're innocent. And a theory that says that the rightness of what they do depends on the total consequences of their actions isn't really going to work. I think it goes deeper too. I have a more recent unpublished paper where I talk about a thing called the Great Oxygenation Event. The Great Oxygenation Event happened a very, very long time ago, early in the history of life on this planet. And it was an event involving catastrophic climate change.
Yeah.
And that the atmosphere of the Earth changed in such a way as to become deadly poisonous to most of the things that were then alive, because a deadly poisonous gas established itself in the atmosphere. And the name of that gas now is oxygen. Most things, living things up to that point, were so-called anaerobic life forms that oxygen is poisonous to. But of course, once that had happened, evolution did its thing, and now the Earth is populated by creatures like us, who depend on oxygen, far from it being poisonous to us. So from our point of view, that was maybe a good thing that happened. From the point of view of anaerobic organisms, it was maybe not such a good thing. And the question I ask in this unpublished paper is, yeah, but was it a good thing that this event occurred? And it seems to me that in more than one way, that question's nonsense. That there isn't an answer to that question. If the Great Oxygenation Event hadn't happened, other stuff would have happened, which you might think might or might not have been better than the stuff that did happen. It might have involved evolution taking different courses, and it might have involved a different kind of creature than human beings ending up at the top of the food chain. A creature the flourishing of which was a very different kind from what counts as flourishing for us. And they're very plausible we know, because we're a neutral way of comparing states of affairs for their goodness, that will be equally meaningful for us and these very different imaginary creatures. And then, of course, there's the same epistemic problem, is that no one can ever know what would have happened had this not happened. And then there's also a serious metaphysical problem about whether there is even a fact of the matter about what would have happened had that not happened. Maybe very plausibly there is a limit to how usefully we can think about the truth of counterfactual. So if I had ever challenged Mike Tyson to a fight, Mike Tyson would have won. Some counterfactuals are like that. They're easy. If I had started a family with my first girlfriend from university, we would have had a great granddaughter called Sophie, who was very good at the clarinet. True or false? Pretty plausibly, there isn't an answer to that question. It would be odd to see how there could be a truth of that kind of matter. So the consequentialist question, which is that you think of any action at all, the action, us having this conversation, and we say, well, does this make the world better? And we might be interested in that. We, quite ordinary people, not philosophers, would like to think that they're making the world a better place. But usually by the world, I think they mean something relatively local. They mean this community. They don't mean the world as in everything, the totality of facts stretching into the distant future. We can't really, making that better, making the whole world a better place. It seems that's too big a thing for us little unimportant creatures to aspire to. We it would be a kind of arrogance to think that we could do that. And I think virtue lies in the mean here. I think there's the vice of being too parochial in what your moral horizons are, of which the extreme would be just complete egoism. All I care about is making Jimmy's life better. Everything else can go hang. That's clearly a mistake, ethically a mistake. Because the idea that I'm trying to make a difference to the whole thing, that seems to be a different kind of mistake, because that's too much for me to take on. I don't want to aim harm at anyone anywhere in the world. But my active attempts to make things better for people, they have to be focused on relatively local people. Relatively can mean not that local. So that, I'm not saying, if you say this, people misunderstand this. Think about the great oxygenation event. And am I saying we shouldn't care about climate change? Goodness me, no. I mean, if climate change make the world really, really bad for our great-grandchildren, that's terrible. That's a reason for us to try and stop it from happening. But will climate change make things bad in the very, very, very long term? Actually, we don't know. We know that if we raise the temperature of the planet by 2, 3, 4 degrees, very bad things will happen for the next few hundred years to human beings and other creatures. But what difference will that have made in a million years? We haven't got a clue. So we can't, if our horizon is a million years, we have no good reason to worry about climate change. Maybe in the very, very long run, this will work out. Maybe just as we're sitting here thinking, was it a good thing the great oxygenation event happened? Because otherwise there couldn't have been us. Maybe some other kind of animal will be sitting around in a million years' time thinking, thank goodness human beings screwed up and made themselves extinct, because that made space for us to evolve. Maybe they're right. But we can't worry about that. But we can worry about what we can foresee, which is the next generation, the next 10 generations, but not the next 10,000 generations. That's not really, I think, possible. And it's not, we shouldn't worry about the fact that that's not possible. I think we should try and you know, not destroy our habitat and pass it on to the people who'll come long after us in decent nick. But those people can take care of themselves. Those people, they themselves can take on the job of making their lives go well, as long as we don't actively make it hard for them. Mm-hmm.
But would you say that morality is in any way objective?
Yes. Objectivity is a complex concept. But at the heart of it, I think, is the idea that you can make mistakes. That might not, I mean, there might be cases of things that are very subjective. It's hard to imagine how you could get something wrong. So if I like chocolate ice cream, I might think, well, chocolate ice cream is delicious for Jimmy. And it would be odd for you to say, no, that's a mistake you're making there, because I enjoy it. And I it would be hard for me to be mistaken about the fact that I enjoy it. And that's all it takes for it to be true, that it's delicious for Jimmy. Whereas in most other interesting cases of knowledge and what purports to be knowledge, we do think you can make a mistake. You know, Jimmy thinks that this person is a good novelist, but actually they're not. They're a terrible novelist. Or Jimmy thinks that this is a good political philosophy, but actually it's not. It's a bad political philosophy. Now, I have a problem in that I come from an ethical tradition that's, broadly speaking, Humean, and that thinks that what normative language generally, and ethical and moral language in particular, are doing is they're expressions of, as Hume would put it, the passions in our souls. In other words, I'm what's now called an expressivist. And people object to that, that if that's true, morality can't be objective. And I think that's not right. And it's not right in two ways. And the first of those ways, everything I had to say about, I'm just straightforwardly stealing from the fantastic English philosopher Simon Blackburn, who talks about this an awful lot. When I moralize, or when I express evaluative or normative thoughts, I'm expressing not just an attitude to the particular thing I'm talking about. Jones stealing the money. Fred phoning his mother on her birthday to wish her happy birthday. I disapprove of this one. I approve of this one. I don't have just these individual attitudes of approval and disapproval towards particular things. I have a whole sensibility of attitudes to different things that has a complicated structure and that coheres. And that complicated structure is what means that I'm not just an emotional creature, but also a rational one, because I'm always seeking to impose more coherence and unity on that structure. And so if you look at the whole structure of my sensibility, you'll see that I have attitudes of approval and disapproval towards particular things, but also I can pick out features of those things that are the thing that I think is wrong about. So suppose someone defrauds my grandmother in her old age. Someone cheats her. Someone sets up some scam and persuades her to invest in some non-existent company and steals her life savings and runs off and spends them on drugs. Well, I think that's wrong. And you say to me, why is that wrong? And I say, well, because look at my poor grandmother. You know, there she is. She's worked all her life and she's made this little nest egg for herself to live on in her old age, and she can't work anymore, and this man's taken it away, and now she's going to be poor. Now she can't afford to live, and she's going to have a wretched life for the rest of her days. This man has done this thing, and he has no good rational justification for doing it. He's done it just out of greed and wickedness. And I'll tell a story about what makes what this man did wrong. At no point in this story will I say, well, and what makes it wrong is that I don't like it. At no point will I say, it's my disapproval that makes it wrong. Because I don't think that. I think on the contrary. I can imagine a world where this man does this thing and I don't disapprove. I think, hey, cool, that was clever. Or I approve in some way. That isn't to imagine a world in which what he did wasn't wrong. That's to imagine a world in which I'm morally corrupt. That's to imagine the world in which I'm a bad person. In saying all of this, everything I just said, what I'm doing is expressing the passions in my soul. That's, as it were, what's going on in terms of what psychologically, if you like, or semantically, if you like. But whether what depends on what, whether the wrongness of what he does depends on how it harms my grandmother or whether it depends on what I feel about it, that's a substantive question. That's a first order question about, and so that what the answer to that is going to depend on what the contents are of the passions in my soul. And if the contents of the passions in my soul are, no, it doesn't depend on whether I approve of it. It depends on other stuff that's independent of me, like the fact that it causes my grandmother to suffer. That's a kind of objectivity. And that's a kind of objectivity that the expressivist can get, I think. Some people are unsatisfied with that Blackburn story. Some people, that's cheating. That's not what we really want in the way of objectivity. And I think that's right, because there's more to objectivity than that. And the key idea here, I think, is the idea of convergence. There is an optimistic view of morality and normativity that some people hold, which is that in ideal circumstances, rational creatures would agree on all normative claims. So maybe we don't. Maybe I think surrogate motherhood is morally wrong and you think it's fine. But that's only because we haven't thought it through properly. Maybe if we discussed it and we were both really rational and we looked at all the evidence really dispassionately, eventually we would converge on an answer. And that answer would be the right answer, because it's the answer on which all rational creatures would converge. Roughly speaking, Kantians think that's true. I don't think it's true. If it was true, you would have a very strong form of objectivity. I don't think it's true, at least I don't think it's true, if we understand the term rational here in a very thin, formal way, if we just mean that we're logically consistent or something like that, as opposed to something more meatier and more substantial. But I don't think it matters that that's false, because we don't really need to worry about all rational creatures, all possible rational creatures. I mean, there's a vast space of possible rational creatures that there could be, and most of those possible creatures aren't actual, don't exist. There's a lovely sentence in Gebhardt that I quote too often in his book, Wise Choices Act Feelings, which is something along the lines of what matters is not what we can say to merely imaginary rational creatures, but what we can say to each other. And what's important, it seems to me, is not whether all possible rational creatures could be brought to converge in a shared understanding of normative truth, but whether that's true of actual rational creatures. And in particular, the body of actual rational creatures that I'm in the business of trying to live with in a functioning society. It's at that level that we want to achieve a kind of convergence. And insofar as we do, then we have a kind of objectivity. But it's a kind of objectivity that is metaphysically fragile. We might not achieve that kind of objectivity. Although we can't help but achieve, there's degrees here. There's two things that are important here when you unpack this. One is stability, and the other is commonality. So here am I, as I say, with my normative sensibility that, you know, I disapprove of investing old people's life savings. I approve of being kind to your mother. I proven. I have this sensibility, and it's a space of judgment. It's also a space of just desires and tastes and things I enjoy. The whole space of the patterns in my soul. And it has a property of being relatively stable. And that's really important, because if it didn't have that property, normative thought making sense altogether. Even very simple normative thoughts, such as what I said before, I like chocolate ice cream. Maybe I don't like peppermint. But this is chocolate ice cream is a reason for me to eat it, and the fact that this is peppermint ice cream is a reason for me not to eat it. But I can only play this game, even this very simple game, because the kind of ice cream I like today is more or less the same as it was yesterday and will be tomorrow. If it just fluctuated wildly, then I'd be lost, and nothing like rationality would get off the ground. I wouldn't be an agent at all. Agency would cease to be possible if there wasn't at least some coherence and stability in my attitudes and responses to things in the world. Stability is, as it were, if you think of just me over time, not being too at odds with myself. So me today, me yesterday, we're on the same page, and that's good. And me tomorrow will be on the same page as me today. So I can plan for tomorrow, knowing that, you know, I won't get up tomorrow and tear up those plans, thinking, what was I thinking? I don't want that stuff anymore. Nothing would work if you didn't have some of that degree of stability. Stability is intrapersonal. It's you can just think about it as an individual over time. Commonality is between persons. So the normative sensibility I have is similar to, in all likelihood, yours in a whole host of ways. And indeed, all human beings' normative sensibilities are very plausibly extremely similar to each other. You might be thinking, well, hang on a sec. look at the world. Look at the conflict there is. Look at that. Sure, but it's the differences jump out. Differences are salient. Differences present themselves as problems. We don't really notice the similarities because they don't present themselves. But there's a lot of similarity to do with a lot of very, what we would think of as very trivial stuff in the background the whole time. So stability and commonality engender a space where objectivity becomes possible, where we can say, look, chocolate ice cream's nice. And that's true. It's true because of the what human beings share, what human beings have in common. And you can make objective value judgments. If you're a talent scout for a modeling agency, and you're looking for a middle-aged man to sell some range of new suits for some clothing company, and into your office walks George Clooney and me, and you point to George Clooney and say, get out, don't waste my time, and you point to me and say, you, yes, you are the best looking of these two men, you should be fired. You're wrong. George Clooney is better looking than me. That's objective. It's objective because even though it's response dependent, our responses are roughly similar. So there can be objective facts about, Mozart is a better composer than Arthur Sullivan. George Clooney is handsomer, sadly, than Jimmy Lenman. Lagavulin is a nicer whiskey than famous grouse. These are objective facts because of commonalities of human sensibility. And such objective facts can include that was your objective in that way can include moral fact. We live in a society that spent many thousands of years trying to build shared moral understandings with some success some of the time, and that means that we share not only certain substantive moral understandings, but also a repertoire of moral concepts that is shaped in all kinds of ways by our nature and our history. And when we come with all that and with the things we have in common to look at the case of the man who steals my granny's mother, we all think, yeah, that's wrong. But what grounds the objectivity of that for a Humean like me is just contingent commonality. The contingent fact that we've managed to create a shared normative understanding where we agree in condemning that. And that coheres in all kinds of ways with other things that are important to us. But we might have been different. We might have been creatures of a very different kind. And then we would have had different normative understandings. There isn't any kind of deep metaphysical necessity driving this. Just the passions in our souls. And some people find that a very frightening thought, and they want this to be kind of grounded in something deeper. But it's not clear what that could be. It used to be clear. It used to be clear that that was God. But that's not something many people can now believe. But people want to say, no, there's us with our emotions and our passions and our sensibilities and our desires and our tastes and our loves and our hates. And we make this fabric of reason and morality that we inhabit. But as well as that, prior to all that, and independently of all that, there's a domain of normative reality. And what we think gets to be true and objectively true by conforming to matching that domain of normative reality. That, I think, is just a mistake. And it's a mistake, I think that even makes sense in a way that would make sense. If there's a domain of normative reality that matches what we are most deeply disposed to believe, if there's a domain of normative reality that says, don't steal granny's money, then that's good. That'll do well. But there might be a domain of normative reality that says, look, steal granny's money. Old people don't count. The happiness of old people doesn't matter. Steal their money. Well, if that's what the domain of normative reality says, the domain of normative reality can go to hell. I'm not going to listen to a domain of normative reality. So it's any authority it gets just by echoing the sensibility that we have already arrived at. And it seems to me to be idle to ask of this sensibility that we've arrived at that it seeks some kind of external ratification from this domain of normative reality that I think is a fantasy. And I think too it's a slightly dangerous fantasy, because many people are, I think, gripped by it, and having been gripped by it, they then become, as is very natural, very sceptical about it. What is the domain of normative reality that's prior to an independent of anything we do? That's, That's how on earth could we know about that? How on earth could we ever have any evidence that there was any such thing? That's a strange hypothesis. No, but because they're so gripped by this idea, that's got to be the case for normative thought to make sense. Once they start to shed this metaphysical belief, it pushes them towards normative skepticism, and they say, okay, well, maybe. Again, in one sense, maybe it's all bullshit. Maybe it's all false. If all this thought only makes sense given this grandiose metaphysical presupposition, and the grandiose metaphysical presupposition is untrue, then none of it makes sense. And that's, I think, there is a fashion for normative skepticism and normative and moral error theory in contemporary philosophy for the last 50 years or so. I think it's partly because, you know, people are gripped by the robust realist idea that there has to be this strange domain of normative reality. And so you have these two groups of people, the robust realists who believe in this domain and think that that's got to be part of the truth for anything we do to make sense, and the skeptics and error theorists who don't believe in it and who jump to the premature conclusion that if there is no such thing, nothing we do makes sense. Actually, everything we do makes sense, but it just doesn't require this fantasy to be true. And forgive me, but the question you asked, can morality be objective? There isn't a short answer. It's not a, there is no one sentence answer. I know I've rabbited on for a very long time, so.
No, I understand. Okay, so I have one last question because we are also getting to our time limit. Do you think it will ever be possible for philosophers to end discussions regarding questions of morality and ethics, and would that be a good thing?
No, and no. My last answer was very long. This one's very short.
Yeah, but
it won't ever happen, and it wouldn't be a good thing if it did. We won't ever. I mean, we're constantly engaged trying to resolve conflict. And it's important to resolve conflict because a lot of unnecessary suffering happens because of conflicts. You know, people have wars, and we want to get rid of that. But we don't want to get rid of difference. We don't want uniformity. We're always going to be, in many ways, a pluralistic society. And I personally think that's good. I like living in a pluralistic society. And I like doing what I'm doing. I like arguing. At least on a good day, I like arguing. It can depend who you're arguing with, how agreeable an experience it might or might not be. But there's always going to be... We're never going to reach the end of inquiry. We're never going to say, okay, we're done now. We know all the answers. And that just seems to me a very plausible claim about the human condition. Normative uncertainty and normative disagreement are just too deeply woven into our lives. But we can try and manage disagreement in better or worse ways. I experience conflict just think of me as an individual. I have conflicting desires that push me in different directions. Again, that's plausibly part of where the rationality comes from, that we need rational deliberation as a way of dealing with the fact that we have conflicting desires. We could just let the strongest desire win, but we don't. We try and bring our reason to bear and try and ask ourselves, say, for example, You know, I'm running the marathon, and I've done 18 miles, and I'm in agony. I just want to stop. It's so hard. It's so difficult. But this, in the back of my mind, I'm saying, don't stop. Don't quit. Because you know what? The pain you're feeling now, running the marathon, it'll be over soon. If you just get to the end, it'll be over. Whereas if you quit, then you'll be furious with yourself tomorrow and next year and 10 years from now. You're like, oh, why didn't I just stick it and get it done and finish it and fight through the pain? So, you know, in the long run. So that's rational thoughts. It's not just that which of these desires is strongest. That's not what's doing the work. And on a good day, rational thought will prevail. But rational thought doesn't get rid of the conflict. It's just a better way of fixing it than other ways might be. And the same way as interpersonal. We don't get rid of conflict, but we have better or worse ways to deal with it. So if you and I disagree about what kind of world we want this to be, what kind of society we want to be, one thing we can do is we can try and kill each other, and whoever successfully kills the other has won the argument. Or we can do other things, more civilized things. We can deliberate together. We can engage in rational deliberation on a collective level. We can discuss it, and we can discuss it with all the other people who have a dog in the fight. And then when we've done discussing it, we can vote on it. And then we resolve it, and then we get on. And no one gets killed. And that's wonderful. What we haven't done is got rid of the conflict. You still disagree with me. You still have your very different sensibility that continues to be in opposition to mine. You've just accepted that, okay, I lost the vote. I decide, no, I'm going to be strong. I'm going to keep running until I get to the end. It still hurts. I haven't stopped the conflicts. I've just resolved it in a relatively good way. It would be. So we want to live together at peace, and to some extent we want to live together in harmony. But I think we could have too much harmony. And then life would be dull. It's like, when I get up in the morning, I know I might meet someone who sees the world differently. And we can have a conversation about it. And maybe I'll learn something. Maybe they're wrong and they're just stupid. But maybe not. Maybe I'm stupid. And maybe I'll grow by having that conversation. You know, encountering people who see the world differently is a really important part of having a rich human life. And if I could just get up in the morning, well, everyone I meet today for the rest of my life will see the world exactly the way I do. That would be weird and not particularly welcome. That's a less short answer.
Okay, so Dr. Lenman, let's end the interview here. Thank you for coming on the show, and it was a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Ricardo. It's been fun talking to you. Cheers.
Hello everybody, thank you for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been doing this channel for 3 years, bringing you top academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields. And I would like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. Even $1 would already be a great help. Otherwise, you also have links to PayPal in the description box of the interview. And please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button if you liked the interview. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perolga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunda, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Kessel, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Anian Kata, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arnold Wolf, Tim Hollisey, Enric Alenius, John Connors, Paulina Baron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Quintis, Rutger Voss, Bo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, Dan Demetriou, Robert Windegger, Rui Inácio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Marco Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Thomas Trumbull, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Mikkel Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Thiago Nunes, Bernard Hugney, Alexander Dunbauer, Omri Hickson, Fergal Cusson, Yevhen Bodrenko, Hal Herzog, Nuno Machado, Don Ross, João Alves da Silva, Jonathan Librant, Oslem Bulut, Nathan Nguyen, Staten T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W., João Eira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yacil Adeza Araújo, Eden Solon, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adaner Usmani, my producer, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Ian Gilligan, Sergio Quadriano, Luis Caetano, Matthew Lavender, Tom Van Egdam, Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardas France, and Niruban Balachandran, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, and James Pratt. Thank you for all.